Case number 14-1227, Henry Omar Carter. Mr. Morrison for the petitioner, Mr. Palmer for the respondent.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This Court should issue a writ of mandamus to recuse Judge Power because he's entered into a discretionary financial relationship with the Secretary of Defense that compromises his independence as a judge. We've raised a great number of issues in the brief, but I think that it really can be comes down to two basic questions that the Court needs to answer to resolve this case. The first is that do the procedures governing Judge Pollard's employment compromise the independence that Congress intended him to have? The second question is, what, if anything, is wrong with Judge Pollard's outside law practice, setting aside issues of bias or appearance of bias? So on the first question, I think the answer comes from the 2009 Act itself. In 2009, Congress enacted a series of reforms that were specifically aimed at enhancing public confidence in military commissions. Among other things, they designated the CMCR a court of record. That is a term of art that has legal significance. And we don't have to guess what it means. We know what it means because the Supreme Court told us in Boumediene. In Boumediene, if I could just read that quote, it said a court of record is a tribunal disinterested in the outcome and committed to procedures designed to ensure its own independence. There, of course, it was contrasting a cert panel, which is an executive panel, and a federal district court. Here we have a similar...
So are part-time civilian judges permissible then, if they have some other employment?
Well, that is the question here. We don't see any basis in the 2009 Act for his ability to be a part-time judge. The default statutory default for federal judges is always full-time employment. Whenever there are some exceptions, obviously. Mm-hmm. The Code of Conduct recognizes that there are exceptions, but the Code says that it's only where permitted by law. And if you look at the few exceptions that do exist, they're all embodied in the statute. So, for example, a federal magistrate can be full-time or part-time, but that's authorized by the Federal Magistrates Act. In addition, Congress specifically said that part-time magistrates are special government employees for purposes of Title 18. So there's nothing discretionary about their ability to practice law and their treatment as a special government employee. Our complaint here...
Is that established? I'm uncertain whether Mr. Pollard was a special government employee. On the one hand, one of his opinions said he was so designated, but then his later opinion said that he just received material about from the Department of Defense, material about and also information that under the previous regime, those judges were special government employees. But I don't see any evidence that he was ever designated. I don't even know how you get designated as a special government.
Well, I do think he is a special government employee. He expressly relies on that to get from under 203A. That was his whole point.
But he has to establish the fact that he relies on the statute, the ethics statute, doesn't prove that he's a special government employee.
Well, we don't think he can be a special government employee in any event because I think it violates the plan.
Is there someone who makes that designation? Is there a form that's filled out that says you are hereby designated an SGE?
Here's my understanding. I'm not exactly sure, to be honest with you. A highly qualified expert is an employment category. Mm-hmm. That defines your pay and your that's the type of employee you are. If you are part-time, that is, if you are you work 130 days a year or less, you're entitled to be treated for ethics purposes as a special government employee. And so long as you don't go over that limit, you're out from under 203A. My understanding is that it follows more or less automatically if you agree to be, I think it's a contractual matter. If there's a contract or an agreement that answers your question, I don't know, because we asked for it and you won't give it to us. At the end of the day, I'm not sure that it matters, because under the plain language of 202, 18 U.S.C. 202, Article I judges cannot be designated special government employees. That's part of the problem with this arrangement. That if we're right about the plain language of 202, he's in fact committing a federal crime, which it would itself be a separate and independent ground to have him disqualified under this court's decision in Microsoft. So to return to the point I was making about court of record, is simply that defines the kind of judge that Congress expected him to be. He's supposed to commit himself to procedures that are designed to ensure his own independence. That's why courts of record have greater deference to their judgments, because they're assumed to be disinterested and so on. And that's what Congress was trying to achieve in the 2009 Act, to give military commission defendants greater level of due process, precisely to enhance public confidence in the outcome. When we look at the terms and conditions of Judge Pollard's employment, it's clear, at least it's clear to us, that he can't possibly be committed to procedures that ensure his independence. He is an Article I judge presiding over a criminal case who has agreed contractually to be an at-will employee of the prosecutor. He's an Article I judge presiding over a criminal case who's agreed.
What do you do with your opponent's argument that by statute the Secretary of Defense is not allowed to interfere? And there's this body of case law out of the UCMJ which gives meaning to that, which suggests a type of independence that is consistent with the judicial obligation.
I guess two responses to that, Your Honor. First, the MCA says that the Secretary cannot use any unauthorized means to interfere with the decision.
And that's where the body of case law comes in. It gives meaning to that, and it suggests that any type of interference would be unauthorized. I know where you're headed.
This is an unauthorized. The Secretary, by statute, is allowed to administer the H-2E program. Now, we think it violates Cotter's rights under the MCA.
Do we have any evidence of the Secretary of Defense exercising that authority that you say he has to terminate a judge or to give them a bonus or an incentive?
I don't know, but I don't think I have to know, because that's my second point, is that the relevant standard for determining whether there is an appearance of bias under 455A is whether a reasonable person who's looking
at... But you know the government's argument is that, no, there's a statute that forbids the Secretary from doing that, and evidence that he's done contrary to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we presume that the Secretary obeys the law.
But that doesn't change the appearance of the arrangement. It also, if I could just...
In the when you say the appearance of the arrangement, really flesh that out. What exactly are you concerned about happening?
The apparent... Judge Pollard is intended to be a judge with an indefinite appointment and good cause tenure. The purpose of giving him those protections would be to insulate him from the influence of the Secretary.
And
he's an at-will employee, mm-hmm. even if he might be an at-will employee, there's going to be at least ambiguity about whether he's going to lose his job or not. I mean, if you don't know whether he's at will, Judge Pollard doesn't know whether or not he's at will, and the public is not going to know whether he's at will. And the standard is, what would the public think? Would it be reasonable to
think? The government's argument, no, we do know that because the Secretary can't interfere.
Well, and with I don't think there's any difference than with respect to the bonus. You are correct that I do not know whether he's gotten a bonus yet. He hasn't told me. I don't know. But he could get one. And that is, that influences.
As a highly qualified expert, he's not entitled to a bonus. He's entitled to a pay increase for extraordinary service, but it's not a bonus.
I'm using bonus in a colloquial sense, Your Honor, and maybe I should be more precise. What he's actually entitled to is a retention incentive award. And that can be paid annually, or it can be paid cumulatively. Under the regulations, under the statute, he's limited to a maximum of 6 years. So in theory, the Secretary of Defense could cut him a check for $300,000-some when he leaves. And what's the public supposed to do with that? The question is...
I think you're right. If that is the case, that would be true. I think we're going to hear from the government that in fact is not the case.
That doesn't depend on whether it's a special government employee at all.
Correct. That's a separate issue. That only relates to his ability to practice law. But the third sort of discretionary element that depends on... I'm sorry. Let me back up for a minute. The point I want to try to get at is... It gives him an incentive to stay in the good graces of the Secretary of Defense. That's the appearance of it, at least. And it's the same with the practice of law, because he's not entitled to be a special government employee. Indeed, we say it's illegal. So the Secretary of Defense has granted him this status, which allows him to maintain his outside practice, and the Secretary could withdraw that status anytime he wants. So Judge Pollard knows the entire time he's acting as a judge that his ability to earn outside income depends on the continuing discretion of the Secretary of Defense. Our argument is that gives him an incentive to favor the Secretary of Defense. And if that's true, that creates an appearance of impropriety, or excuse me, an appearance of bias, and he is disqualified.
Now, the government says, just on the at-will issue, which is a little different from what you were just talking about, the government says that he's only removable for cause.
He's only supposed to be removable for cause. We agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
That was the nature of the appointment that he accepted. Our position is that he bargained that away when he agreed to become an HQA.
Mm-hmm.
So he's bargained away the mm-hmm. tenure that he had.
And then the government comes back and says, well, the statute, though, as Judge Griffith's pointing out, really precludes use of the set of that provision in that way. I guess your response is, well, we'll see, but the uncertainty is too much of a problem.
Exactly. That's my response. I see that I'm within my rebuttal time, so I will, if there are no further questions. Oh, excuse me. I do want to make one other point before I sit down. If we're right, there is irreparable harm here because Judge Pollard is at least, there's an appearance of bias, if nothing else. The government hasn't offered this court any reason to not err on the side of caution. Because if he's removed, there's not going to be any harm to the process. There are four judges on my panel, three of whom are military judges. So if Judge Pollard is recused, the case just goes on and these issues drop out of the case.
What was Congress's purpose in having civilians appointed to this court?
Congress just decided that there were going to be two classes of judges. And they treated their tenure differently. I actually don't know exactly why Congress decided to do that. That's quite unusual. It may well be that they wanted more stability from the civilian judges, because the military judges rotate on and off, which is...
Wasn't it an appearance of independence by having outsiders as part of the process and not just military judges?
I think you're right. I agree with that. That is part of it. Civilians not connected to
the
military.
That's the irony of this, is that bringing in the outsiders, the civilians who are not in the military culture,
correct,
is now being viewed as threatening the independence, quote unquote, of the military judges.
The irony here is that the military judges have far more practical independence than Judge Pollard does.
Right.
There's no military judge that's an at-will employee of the Secretary
right.
of Defense, even apparently.
But I think Congress was concerned about the appearance of military judges.
Correct.
Right. Yeah.
What arguments that you've made here today could you not make on an appeal from the decision of the three-judge court?
an appearance of bias is waivable. So I think I probably have to raise it on mandamus. It's well established that that's irreparable
harm. But you haven't waived it. Yeah. I mean, that's the point. Liljeburg, for example, the Supreme Court's decision there came long after that district judge sat on the case, and that was an appearance of bias case. So I don't know why we need the mandamus at this point. Why not just wait for the decision of the court and then review it on appeal?
Well, I think the best answer to that is what the court said in Shiri last year, and that is a judge who is biased is a classic case of irreparable harm. It's irreparable harm to the petitioner, to Mr. Cotter, because it's impossible to tell on direct appeal all the ways that bias may have infected the decision.
Then you reverse.
It's also, well, that could be corrected with him, but you can't correct the harm to the public interest. And that's the other part of the irreparable harm. Allowing a case to proceed with a biased judge necessarily undermines public confidence in the integrity of the
system.
But
isn't that corrected by reversal as well?
Not according to the mandamus case law. That's why it's a classic case for mandamus.
Is it personal bias or is it appearance of bias?
It is only appearance of bias that affects the public interest.
Personal bias, actual bias does too, doesn't it?
Right, but the appearance of harm standard is what gives rise to irreparable harm to the public interest in the integrity of the system.
But this raises another point, which is that you could raise it on appeal, of course. You want mandamus to correct it now, but the standard for mandamus, as you're well aware, is clear and indisputable, right, and lots of adjectives like that we use. And the uncertainty, I guess this is my concern, the uncertainty about how this pay arrangement may play out or the worst-case scenarios, and I know you would dispute that characterization, but the worst-case scenarios about how it might play out seem inconsistent with saying, as of this moment, there's some clear and indisputable right to relief.
Well, I think the clear and indisputable right to relief is to avoid the irreparable harm that is caused by having to submit to a proceeding where there's a biased judge, precisely because how are we going to be able to prove after the fact that he was in fact biased? We're not going to be in any better position than we are now.
Well, if he votes for your client and the other two judges vote the other way, it's pretty clear.
We'll see how that turns out. There are no further questions.
We'll give you some time back. Thank you very much. We meet again, Mr. Palmer. It's been a good week.
Good to see you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm Joseph Palmer for the Justice Department. I'd like to begin by saying that that Judge Griffith's characterization of our reliance on the statutory guarantee of independence by the CMCR judges is principally what we're relying on here.
But then, can you just explain to me in plain English his removability, pay, and bonuses? And that's I've been a government employee for 25 years, so I know that. That's what every government employee wants to know. Removability, pay, bonuses. What is the status for this person?
Your Honor, in the record, I think the best source for that information is the statement by the CMCR clerk that's in the joint appendix beginning at page 41 that indicates that he is paid a particular hourly rate and then states that that's it for pay.
Okay, so that's the $79 an hour, I think it is.
Yeah, I think that's correct, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And so there isn't any indication in the record in this case that there has ever been a bonus paid or a bonus offered.
But is it possible? This is my question. In other words, every government employee knows, if I do good work, I can get that end-of-the-year bonus. Is that possible here?
It may be possible in theory, but it would clearly be inconsistent with the Military Commissions Act
okay.
for such a bonus to have any.
So are you going to rule out then, or is someone going to rule out the payment of a bonus for a situation like that? If I could get a $20,000 bonus at the end of the year from you know, Congress or the president, that, you know, people would question my impartiality.
Right, and because of that, that's why we think then that the statute is what governs and makes it so.
But you just said,
does that preclude the bonus? Yeah. Does the statute preclude a bonus? Are you willing to say that? Is someone willing to say that?
Yes, I think it does, Your Honor, that the statute, it would be hard to imagine.
What did you mean then when you said theoretically that's possible?
I just meant what I wanted to do was to not concede that under the regulations that apply to HQEs, that there is a provision for those payments.
Absent the statutory provision, it might have been theoretically possible, but you're saying the statutory provision makes that not possible.
Yes, I think.
Okay, so we can X out the possibility of bonuses or incentive awards or whatever nomenclature you might put on that?
Yes, I think that the statute makes it so that the existence of that kind of incentive in the circumstance of a CMCR judge would be
inconsistent. So we got the pay and the bonuses cleared up. How about the removability?
Well, the removability, again, I think isn't governed by the regulations or by the designation. It's governed by the statute or by the constitutional status of a judge who has been appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate.
So what are you telling me?
So under the Supreme Court's case in Weiner that we've cited in our brief, the statute is silent about whether the removability of the judges.
Right. So Weiner had implied for cause protection, right?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying applies here? There's an implied for cause protection.
I think that's probably correct, because the Weiner doctrine applies.
But if it's only probably correct, this is what his concern is, then the judge will think I'm removable at will if I issue a harsh decision against the government, and that's the whole point here. So knowing, it's not good enough to just know after the fact. You have to know up front. That's why we have life tenure. You have to know up front what your tenure is so that you're not concerned about being removed for a decision that's unpopular. So do we know up front? Are you willing to say that? Is the government willing to say there is for cause protection?
We've said that in the brief, Your Honor, and I think that's I don't know that there has been an official statement by the government that's
you're comfortable if our opinion says that you've said that there's for cause protection, are you comfortable with that?
I think so, Your Honor. We certainly haven't disputed that.
Okay.
And or made any arguments for why that would be.
We have no bonuses and we have for cause protection. That's eliminates a lot of the problem.
Again, the government's position is that the statutory protections in the Military Commissions Act are what is the and as Judge Griffith mentioned, the case law that goes
just on that. So I just connect the dots here. The statutory protections are why you're willing to say no bonuses and for cause protection.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But although I should say that I don't think that we would concede that if the.
By the way, we don't know what for cause protection means, but someday we'll figure that out after 80 years of. But anyway.
Indeed, Your Honor. But let me say this. I think that if it were. Congress could have made the judges specified that they were. Did not have for cause protection.
Right.
And in that circumstances, I still think we would say that they are sufficiently independent.
Well, for due process purposes, perhaps, but it's because 455 kicks in here, right?
It does. It's incorporated through the court's rules.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with, since we're on 455, what do you do with Section 454? How do you get around that? It says no judge appointed under the authority of the United States. Well, is any judge appointed under the authority of the United States that practices law is guilty of a high misdemeanor?
Yes,
he's a judge. He was appointed under the authority of the United States.
Our position is that's a term of art that applies to Article III judges and also to the specified non-Article III courts that are enumerated in Section 460. So Section 460 states that that certain provisions of that chapter, including Section 454, apply also to the Court of Federal Claims and to judges of territorial courts. And the fact that that it specifies those two particular non-Article III courts indicates Congress's intent that that provision not apply.
So you apply expressio unius across statutes, not within a statute. And the Supreme Court has warned against that sort of analysis, has it not?
But I think in this circumstance, it's appropriate because the Section 460 cross-references those other statutes explicitly, including Section 450.
If we disagreed with your analysis and thought that we just have an example of some redundancy here, Congress is redundant all the time, and that 454 does apply here, what then?
I think if the court determined that it was clear and indisputable that Section 454 prohibited CMCR judges from practicing law.
That's the hypothetical.
Then, in that circumstance, what we would have here is a good faith and an unintentional violation of that provision. And so this court would not need to grant the writ and order disqualification, but rather clarify the meaning of that statute.
The writ requires bias, doesn't it? I mean, our case law says it's when we're looking at mandamus and recusal, it has to include bias. So I would have thought your answer would have been more along those lines, that there's nothing about practicing law that would show bias.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. So I was already moving
threshold. And it's not a recusal statute either, is it, 454? 455 is. 454 is not a recusal statute, is it? I don't believe so.
I don't think it is, Your Honor. And so I agree with you.
At least Wright and Miller doesn't list it as one of the three recusal statutes. So.
I think we agree that the kind of structural disqualification type claims that the defendant or that the petitioner raises here are analogous to the kind of claims that were raised in Nashiri and that this court found inappropriate for mandamus relief because although they went to the structural independence of the military judges on the court, they didn't raise a claim of personal bias. They didn't indicate that the judge had some personal animus or direct financial profit in the outcome. That kind of claim, the kind of claim that courts have found mandated.
Do you know what the origin of 454 is? I think it's the cross-reference in the code version I have here says it was enacted in 1948. Was that the revision of the judicial code?
I don't know the answer to that.
You know, there was a great controversy about somebody named Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Do you know who he was?
Commissioner of Baseball.
Yes, Your Honor, in the baseball context.
He was a federal district judge at the same time. And I'm wondering whether that provision was enacted because of his dual role as Commissioner of Baseball plus the... But that's not practice of law, so... Maybe it is.
I'm not familiar with the history, Your Honor, although I think we would concede that generally, for full-time judges, the practice of law is inappropriate. And what the argument here is that in the context of a part-time court that Congress understood would be part-time, law of war courts are necessarily convened as needed. The predecessor Court of Military Commission Review was part-time. There's never been a sufficient number of cases on the docket to warrant a full-time judges or staff. The fact that the appellate military judges are necessarily part-time because they serve also on their respective service courts of appeals indicates that Congress understood that this would be a part-time
court. How do we know that he's a special government employee? You heard the questions that were asked of your colleague here, and I just don't find any evidence of that. What is the procedure for deeming someone a special government employee?
I think that the statute empowers in this circumstance, the Secretary of Defense to designate executive branch employees and officers as special government employees. And I think in this case, again, referring to the statement by the court of the CMCR in the appendix at the beginning at page 41, it does indicate that both the predecessor civilian judges and the current civilian judges have been designated.
Well, I don't find the current. I find a statement by Judge Pollard saying that he was received correspondence from the Department of Defense saying that under the old regime, they were designated special government employees, and that he received some material. There's nothing in there in his last iteration saying that he was so designated.
I'm not sure that he stated it in so many words, but I think that the clear implication of his opinion is that he considers himself to be a special government employee, and I think that's also how the...
But you suggested that there's actually a formal designation that occurs at some place, that before perhaps you're retained, someone makes a decision that you can be retained as a special government employee, or do you know?
I don't know, except to say that in this case, the way that I read the statement by the clerk of the court, that they did make that decision, that that's how they would treat both the predecessor civilian judges and these civilian judges.
You have to get that, don't you, in any government agency, or else there are all sorts of ethics things that kick in that you would be violating because you have outside employment, right?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And
he says in his opinion, contrary to the petitioner's contention, I did not request to be designated an HQE or SGE, nor did I ever discuss this with anyone in the executive branch during the nomination or confirmation process. And then he had this email that he talks about with material that where's the evidence of who was designated as special government employee?
Well, I think those statements, Your Honor, were in the context of the claim by the petitioner that he had voluntarily given up his statutory and constitutional protections in order to obtain SGE status, that he had explicitly solicited it. And what he was trying to say there was just that he qualifies as an SGE and has been designated, but that he hadn't affirmatively sought that out, and by being designated as an SGE, that didn't mean that he had somehow given up the structural protections that are his according to the Constitution and
statute. Here are the words. It's on JA-181. After the email, he said, in response, a few days later, I was provided with some general information regarding special government employees and told that the judges on the predecessor court had been designated SGEs. He didn't say anything about whether he was.
Your Honor, I think, and in particular in the earlier order, so there are two orders that the...
Well, he's clearing up the earlier order. That's why, because he said in the earlier order that he was designated, and now he's saying no, or not no, but he's saying I just got some general information and information about the predecessor. This is really a rather critical question, isn't it? Because if he's not a special government employee, hasn't been designated, then the ethical restrictions are clearly applied.
I think that's right that it's important, Your Honor. I just read the overall thrust of both of his orders to be that he considers himself to be an SGE and as such is subject to the narrower conflict of interest rules in Section 203.
So that's enough if he considers himself, not whether the Secretary of Defense ever designated him as such.
I don't know that there's any... That
there are all these rules. I looked at the regulations on the highly qualified experts, and there are detailed rules about how that those individuals get designated as HQEs and who can do it and who has the authority, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Are there such rules with respect to special government employees?
If there are, they aren't in the record.
I know that.
And I guess I'm not certain of the answer, but I don't know that it's been in dispute in this case that I don't take the petitioner to be saying that there's some fault with the designation of the SGE. Indeed, the petitioner's position is that he can't be an SGE.
Well, that's
because of by statute, not by that there's been an insufficient certification by the Department of Defense.
You're saying it's undisputed, or it has not been disputed, that he is an SGE.
No, petitioner's claim is that he is statutorily ineligible under the definition to be an SGE, but not that there's that in terms of the, I mean, I don't know that I should speak for petitioner, but I don't take them to have disputed the question of whether the executive branch has done what it must do to
And the prior, the Griffin Bell and Coleman, when they were on the prior formulation of this, they were SGEs.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Marshall.
First of all, I need to thank you, Judge Randolph, for mentioning Kennesaw Mountain Landis, because I now want to bet, because I was told I could not work that into this oral argument. But to answer your question, that incident gave rise to the Code of Conduct for United States judges.
Well, I know that.
454 dates to 1812.
But it's not the Code of Conduct we have now.
Correct. It's been revised over time. That was the first code.
Yeah, Roscoe Pound.
But your question was the origin of 454, and it dates to 1812. So it is a fundamental, long-standing rule of judicial ethics.
It was passed initially when?
1812.
Oh.
So a couple of points. We aren't making a structural claim. We're making the opposite of that. Nashiri was a constitutional challenge to a provision of the MCA that dealt with the assignment of military judges. That's a structural challenge. We're complaining that they're not fulfilling the structure that Congress gave us.
Now, what if they're ineligible for bonuses and they're protected by for-cause protection, as the government has confirmed / conceded here?
Well, I didn't hear it as that definitive, but I'll assume with your question that it is. Mm-hmm. That doesn't completely solve the problem, because we still have the practice of law.
But that solves those problems.
That solves those problems. Mm-hmm. There are two problems with the practice of law. One is it's still dependent on the Secretary's discretion. So he's still relying on the good grace of the Secretary to allow him to do that while serving as a judge. And we say that creates the same sort of financial conflict. Secondly, if it's illegal or impeachable, then it is impropriety. It's actual
impropriety. The 454 point, you mean?
454 and 203.
And 203.
And in response to your question, Judge Griffith, I think he can be removed.
That's not necessarily a 455 problem, is it?
I think under Microsoft it is. Microsoft says that violations of the Code of Conduct, if they rise to the level where they impugn the integrity of the judiciary, are grounds for disqualification under 455, mm-hmm, for the same reason. They create an appearance of impropriety that undermines confidence
Talking to reporters about a case seems far afield from this, however. Let me ask you about 203.
Yes,
I don't believe you addressed this in your main argument, but maybe you did, and I've just forgotten it. Do you have any evidence that Judge Pollard actually violated 203, that he had clients who were in litigation with the United States at the time, that he was representing? Is there any evidence of that? I know there's the statement on the firm's website.
Correct.
But beyond that, is there any evidence? I couldn't find it.
The state of the record is this. We challenged him on 203 grounds, and we said, it appears to us that you were violating the statute.
Right.
His response was not, you're incorrect, I'm not violating the statute. His response was, I don't have to follow that. I'm not subject to 203A. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that, coupled with the fact that he clearly advertises that he has a federal practice, that's tantamount to a concession that he's, in fact, not complying with these significant constraints that 203A would put on his practice. If there are no further questions.
Great. Thank you very much. The case is submitted.